It's time to wake to sleep with the number one sleep authority, Sleep Science Today, and Sleep Better Tonight.
If babies are supposed to sleep, why are so many exhausted parents doing everything right and still up at 3 a.m.? This is Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. Today, we're going to be talking with Alex Dubief. She is an author and baby sleep expert. Her book is Precious Little Sleep. So, Alexis, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Andrew. Thrilled to be here.
Well, we have a lot to talk about today because a lot of people have lots of questions about this new human in their life, and they don't know what to do or how to handle it. They don't want to break it, and all sorts of sleep issues come up. So why don't we start off the show today, and maybe you can give us some unique challenges that parents face when dealing with either a newborn, a toddler, you know, anything related to children at sleep.
Yeah, and I think it's multi-factor, right? So if we look at most modern parents, they are living in a glut of inputs, right? Like we've got TikTok, Instagram, you know, we're just sort of like this nonstop input of like what you should be doing and how, you know, how good parents behave and what good sleepers look like. And if you don't do XYZ, you're ruining your child. So there's like an immense amount of sort of pressure and kind of compulsion to achieve a certain standard of this, again, set by social media that didn't exist. You know, I mean, my kids are teens. It didn't exist when I was becoming a parent. And on top of this, right, so we have this like kind of loud, noisy, complicated, confusing, sort of anxiety-inducing flood of information. And then we have parents who most of us, let's be honest, haven't really had exposure to babies until we had one, right? You know, just a lot of times the first time you touched a baby was when it popped out of your body and they hand it to you and you're like, oh my God, like, what are we doing here? And then, you know, definitely in the US, but certainly not exclusive to the US, we have a lack of parental support. We have a lack of, you know, paid leave in the U.S. I know it's better in other countries. So we have a very short runway, if any runway at all, to kind of physically and emotionally recover from this process, figure out how to care and feed for a baby. And all the while we are, you know, sort of struggling with anywhere up to 3 to 8 wakes per night. So our sleep is wildly fractured. Mm-hmm. So it's a vortex of heart for a lot of parents.
Right, right. Well, yeah, I can only imagine, you know, you're trying to manage a daily life that you had before you had this new person in your home, and now everything changes, and your sleep is not go to bed, fall asleep, enjoy it, and then wake up.
No, it's a 24-hour job.
Yes, yes. So Let's talk about some of the issues that parents would run into, because there's a lot of controversy out there about a lot of different approaches that people take. So in order to get into that, why don't we sort of list out some of the common problems that we might see that parents struggle with?
Sure. So for newborns, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics, which to me is the default for best practices when it comes to infant safety. They are very clear on what a safe sleep environment for a child is, right? Unambiguously clear. In a crib, on their back, no other items in there, right? No soft bedding, blankets, nothing, entrapment hazards. So when you have a newborn, it is common for newborn, you know, 3, 4, 5-week-old babies to absolutely refuse to sleep in this configuration. Like, absolutely. And so parents are stuck with a child who will only sleep upright, being held by a parent. And then, which we know is inherently unsafe and problematic, especially if the parent is asleep. Fine when you're awake, not okay if you're asleep.
Right.
And so parents are like, wait, what am I supposed to do here? Right? I can't stay awake 8 hours at night holding a child on the couch. But if my child's butt hits the crib for 5 seconds, they're screaming. And so that's a real challenge. Now, a lot of times we can kind of limp through that period with family help, sleeping in shifts, but it is an inherently hard time because even if you're sleeping in shifts, a 4-hour stint of holding a child while you're just absolutely rock solid exhausted and holding yourself to the standard of staying awake is a challenge. You know, and now you add on having given birth, possibly having a C-section, you've had major medical procedures. It's a real challenge. And then you kind of morph into past the newborn phase, which luckily is, you know, for most kids, like 2.5 months. It's hard, but it feels eternal, but it does end. Then we move into parenting a baby where, you know, better sleep is now possible. Not saying it's a fast pass. It just flips a switch and it happens. But now it's possible. And now we have the internet telling you that anything that you might do to help foster that child's ability to sleep well in a safe sleep space is tantamount to child abuse. That if you're not holding them, if you try to wean off a feeding or two, that you're withholding love and care. And, you know, this would be a behavior that would lead to, you know, attachment disorders and all kinds of, you know, horrific outcomes that no parent would ever want for their children. So I'm not saying that's true, but that is the message that a lot of parents get. And so often they feel trapped. They're like, wait, what am I supposed to do? I can't get my kid in the crib. It's not safe to hold them. I'm dying, you know, but if I make any steps to help improve the outcomes, you know, I'm a terrible parent. And the one thing that every parent is crystal clear on is that the care of their child is their number one priority.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. Well, you know, you make a really good point there about, you know, there is indeed a difference between the scientific tested, you know, methods and issues related to kids, and then the thing that somebody decided to just say on the internet. And oftentimes, you know, yeah, you're very concerned about doing the right thing for your kid, and you want to make sure you're doing the right thing, and you're getting barraged with all this information.
Yes.
But it's important at the end of the day to remember someone's opinion is their opinion, and they're entitled to their opinion. But it is not the science. It is not what has been tested and proven. So if you want what's best for your child, you got to see what's been tested and proven to be the case. So
yeah, but tired parents are not digging into that.
Right, right.
Like they're like, I barely ate two slices of sliced turkey lunch meat for dinner. I don't have time to dig into the science. Like, what are you? I haven't showered since Tuesday, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's where it's always important to consider the source of the information, because there is a lot of good information available. You just have to look for the right sources. One of the reasons we do this show is providing valid information to people. So, all right. So you got mom, you got dad typically, you know, in the home there. Is it better for one or the other to be the one who's, you know, giving the care? Should they split it evenly? What's the right way?
No, I mean, look, any loving caregiver can provide care for a child. That could be mom, dad, grandma. You know, some families with more resources will have, you know, a postpartum doula that can help out, you know, aunts, uncles, whatever. So anyone can provide care. I will say overwhelmingly in my experience, the primary caregiver, the default stay-at-home parent is almost always the mother. And I don't mean to say that as a gendered bias. It just is my observation.
Okay. And so let's kind of take this step by step. We've got new parents, first baby, no experience. You know, they've probably read a lot of stuff trying to prepare. But the reality is typically not the same as what they've read, you know, because now they're actually holding this new child. Walk us through what should they be prepared for before they even take the child home from the hospital? And what things should they be looking for?
So I'm going to come back to the newborn phase or the fourth trimester or whatever we want to call it. And there's a Mike Tyson quote that says, everybody has a plan until they're punched in the mouth. And that's kind of how I view it. Like for many, many parents, it is a shock. And all of the books and preparations and baby lists of, you know, products aren't going to change the shock. So I would be prepared that nothing's going to get done. Like when parents tell me like, oh, you know, this kid, I can't get them to sleep and I'm holding them all day and I can't even like, you know, I'm like, yeah, nothing's going to get done, you know, and the dog's not going to get walked and your two-year-old's going to be dismantling the living room and dinner will be whatever. You know, that is a reasonable expectation to have. And so not to be a bummer, but to say, like, let's come in eyes open. Getting a child to sleep is incredibly difficult. Many newborns will only sleep while held. And some newborns will only sleep while held in a dark room with white noise. Right. So again, if I've got a 3-year-old, that becomes a real challenge. So like, what is my contingency plan? Which neighbor can I shuffle the older kid off to? Which grandparent can come spend a month or two at our house? Like, what are my options? I think night sleep will be, we know, is wildly fractured, right? Until the circadian rhythm kind of coalesces typically around 2, 2.5 months. And so it's not even that they wake up, you feed them, they go back to sleep. It's that they're going to wake up and then be awake for an hour. Right. And then go right back to sleep. So you might be up from 12 to 1 and then from 3 to 4. And then so when I talk about sleeping in shifts, I mean, literally somebody's got to go to bed at 8 and they sleep 8 to 1 and then they're going to be on duty from 1 to 6 and to plan on that.
Uh-huh.
And I think a lot of people think that this is a sign of a problem. And I'm like, no, that's normal newborn behavior. That they nap 24 hours a day. They don't have a consolidated night. They don't have the capacity for it. And there's not a fix for it. Because a lot of people are like, well, how do I fix this? What can I buy on, you know, Amazon? Like, what can I order? Right. You know, right? The right swaddle will fix this. I'm like, no, no. So that is a phase we all must go through. And it's like the tax that we have to pay to get a baby. It's a hard time. It's not for, it feels eternal, but it's not forever. And then, you know, from months 3 to 5 really are not key, but like now we can make positive changes. Now we're in a place where we can like start chipping away and moving towards a more manageable, reasonable, you know, night duration. Many, many parents don't. They just kind of like stay in survival mode until 8, 9 months and they hit the wall. But like in an ideal situation, if everything's going great, there's no medical complications, you know, life is good, you know, 3 to 5 months is the time to kind of look towards saying, okay, now we have a baby. They're not a newborn anymore. The capacity for longer uninterrupted stretches of sleep exists. What are the steps I can be taking to kind of, you know, move away from survival mode, sleeping in shifts, like limping through the day towards a more intentional approach to setting up healthy sleep hygiene?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So kind of having a plan and sticking to it and following it through.
And that really is my key message. Months 3 to 6 is the time to kind of pull out, right? You know, we can got to get out of this and not just to kind of like limp along until 8, 9, 10 months. Because at 8, 9, 10 months, if like, first of all, we're all like beat down and we have a kid who's an older baby who has deeply engraved patterns of behavior, fixing sleep with a 10-month-old without tears is nigh on impossible. So we have a lot of tools in our toolbox at 3, 4, 5 months and not a whole lot of tools at 10 months. Doesn't mean we can't do it. But then the whole internet drama about, you know, oh, crying is bad, which I don't subscribe to at all, comes into play in the guilt and the shame and all of that. So children can move to healthy sleep patterns at any age, but it's certainly preferable to skip 10 months of misery and kind of make gradual changes when they're younger.
Right. Well, so I want to follow up on something you said there because it's really important. And I know the audience has these questions. Parents obviously want to do the right thing for their child. And they're very concerned about, you know, I've seen so many who they want to research everything and make sure they know exactly what's to, you know, going to happen. What when a baby is crying and I'm going to give it to you at night. What does the cry normally mean, and what is the best response? Because the tendency is to say, I want to go grab my baby and hold my baby because I don't want them to be feeling uncomfortable because they're crying.
Of course.
But what's the real message from the baby, and what's the best response from the parent?
That's a complicated question, and it really depends on a number of factors. So let's break down the big picture. Number one is... children can wake up crying at night because they are either undertired or overtired. And overwhelmingly, and I mean this like capital O, overwhelmingly, modern babies are undertired. I almost never see overtired. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. It is just vastly less common.
Uh-huh.
So if a parent is listening and they're wondering if their child is overtired or undertired, I'm going to bet money that they're probably under tired. So if I'm napping too much, or if I'm not awake enough during the day and I'm waking up at night because I'm not tired enough, I'm just going to be upset and cranky. Like, I don't want to hang out alone in a dark crib. Like, oh, this sucks. So, Right. So that can be one reason. Another reason can be that they're hungry, especially babies. If you're used to eating at certain times during the day, if my baby always wakes up to eat at 1 and 4 and they're crying at 1, their body has habituated to eating then and they're hungry. Like, they're telling you it's time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's reason number 2. Reason number 3 is sleep onset association issues. So if I am doing something to help my baby fall asleep, and classically it's cuddling, bouncing, feeding, right?
Right.
If I'm doing something until they are fully asleep and I slide them into their crib once they are deeply, deeply unconscious, they are asleep. As they cycle through light sleep, which all babies do multiple times at night, and that activity is not present, I've gone missing. There's no longer a bottle or a nipple in their mouth or whatever the situation is. Uh-huh. They're going to go, hey, where'd you go? What happened? What am I doing here? And they're going to wake up in great distress, and they will only resume sleep if I recreate what was happening at bedtime. So there are different reasons why kids wake up at night. And the challenge, which is not simple, I'm not trying to pretend like this is, you know, easy peasy stuff, is to suss out and get kind of a scientist approach to, okay, what is this telling me? What are my possible hypotheses here? How do I test these so I can narrow in on not just, you know, reducing the crying because it's distressing, which of course it is, but also like helping them to be more successful, helping them to not wake up in distress at night, because nobody wants that.
Right, right. Well, that's really helpful to kind of lay that out. And, you know, the obvious question then comes, you know, how do you know which one of these things it is that's bothering the child? But before you answer that, we got to take a break. And we'll come back and we will get the answer. So this is Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We are talking with Alexis Dubieff, and we will be back on Sleep Science Today.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job. She was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach. Here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
All right. We are back on Sleep Science Today, and we left you with a bit of a cliffhanger. But we were talking about the babies at night and crying. What does a crying mean? And Alexis gave us a whole list of possible things. So So I'm a new parent. I don't know all the science behind it. How do I figure it out?
Yeah, it's not easy. Well, some are easier than others. So let's take the most common scenario is if your baby's been waking at two times, you know, within 30, 40 minutes, they wake up twice a night at roughly the same times. If they're waking up at that time, then that's probably your answer, right? If I, you know, for the last 3 months, I've been feeding my baby at 1 and 4, they're waking up at 1 and 4. Yeah, we know the drill. This is time. So in that case, it's pretty straightforward. For the most part, you know, once babies are 4 or 5 months, like their night feedings tend to be pretty, you know, not wildly random anymore. And then the second issue is if they're waking up a million times at night and the only way you can get them back to sleep is by doing whatever it is that you do at bedtime. And usually it's very quick, right? So like babies like wide awake, distressed, upset, and you rock them to sleep at bedtime and you pick them up and you rock them for, in some cases, like 2 minutes. They are out like a light switch. That's your answer. The problem is that the rocking to sleep or feeding to sleep or bouncing to sleep, whatever it is, cuddling to sleep, works for younger babies because they do not have the capacity to remember you were there. So there is no, oh my gosh, where did you go? Because they don't remember. Wow. But their brains are exploding. And so at some point, and this can be anywhere between 3 months to 18 months, but it's most often in the 3 to 6 month zone, helping them fall fully to sleep at bedtime will fail. And the behavior will be very clear, what I just described. Now, you're going to go online, you're going to go on Reddit, and you're going to go on TikTok, and they're going to get a whole bunch of wild theories about why this is. They're not eating enough. It's the 4 month sleep regression. They're teething. It's separation anxiety. Your milk's drying up. I mean, like, whatever. There's going to be a laundry list of excuses. None of those are true. Your child has wised up to you, and they can only sleep if you continue to provide the services you were providing at bedtime every time they cycle through light sleep all night long. It tends to get progressively worse as you get towards morning, right? So you might get like a 4 hour stretch at bedtime and then a 2 hour stretch, and then it's every 60 minutes until dawn, right? So it's a pretty clear pattern. So if you're fitting into that pattern and your child's not falling asleep on their own at bedtime, you've hit the wall. It works for a while. It works great. And then it stops working. And that's where you are. The schedule stuff is a lot more tricky. So most sources of information that parents are going to are pushing for very high amounts of sleep. And it baffles me. And often I get a lot of pushback from families who are like, Alexis, your numbers are so much lower than everybody else's. And I'm like, show me a study. Where is the evidence that babies can sleep 12 hours a night? Study after study suggests the average is 10 to 11 bell curve. Yeah, sure. 5-7% of kids can sleep 12 hours a night, and it's glorious for those parents. That's great. Like, right? Like, sign me up. I'll take it. But for 90%+ of us, that's an impossible goal. And so when I come back and say, you know, they're like, well, XYZ says they need to sleep 12 hours a night, and my friend's cousin sleeps 12 hours. I'm like, well, great. That's beauty for them. Some kids can only do 9. But 10 to 11 hours is going to be where most kids are going to fall. And if I am like struggling to, you know, stretch my kid into a 12-hour night, or if I'm, you know, contact sleeping and nursing and feeding and like doing all kinds of, I call it concierge services throughout the day to get them to take 2 and 3 hour naps, and then they're up all night. You know, we have to look at the basic biology, which is that human beings get tired by being awake. And if your child's never awake, they're not going to have the capacity to sleep well. And so when I talk about, you know, right-sizing the schedule or being willing to trial less sleep, I hit a lot of resistance, and I am almost always right. I mean, you know, look, not always, because, you know, some babies need a ton of sleep. And so for sure, I don't have some magical ability to intuit the right schedule for any human being. But when we see these behaviors, I'm like, well, let's experiment with less. Let's, you know, kind of look at a shorter night. Let's look at longer amounts of time being awake during the day. It is very hard for parents to hear that. And again, I think that's because, you know, there's like a best-selling baby sleep book called 12 Hours by 12 Weeks, which sets the expectation that all babies are sleeping 12 hours. And it's absolutely not true.
Right, right. Well, so tell me a little bit more about that from this perspective. You said one of the issues that can be a problem is that the baby is under-tired. So that would lead us to believe that they're sleeping too much during the day. So if the baby during the day can sleep or wants to sleep, Are you saying we need to kind of make sure they're not sleeping a certain time? How does someone kind of balance that out?
Well, I think wants to sleep is I'm not sure how we know when babies want to sleep. So for the most part, when babies are sleeping a lot, it is only under certain circumstances, which is, again, the concierge treatment. So that might be like a 5-month-old or a 7-month-old who naps with mom sort of like on the breast, you know, like human pacifier kind of a syndrome. So mom's like in a dark room holding the kid, you know, and when you provide, and again, this is 20 years of experience, when you provide massive levels of soothing to an infant, you can almost compel them to sleep. They're going to fall asleep. And so the issue then becomes, okay, great. That's great. Like if you want to do that, if you have the, you know, the privilege and the resources to provide that service all day and you want to do it, great. How many hours are they awake a day? And then how are they sleeping at night? So if a child can nap for 3, 4, 5 hours a day and then still sleep for 10, 11 hours at night and sleep well, you don't have a problem. You have a high sleep needs baby. Uh-huh. You know, what do we know is that on average, most kids past 6 months are going to sleep around 13 hours a day, right? That's just study after study. Like that's about the right number, you know, give or take an hour. There's huge variability in human existence. But, you know, so if you are providing concierge services and, you know, you're getting your 7, 8-month-old to sleep for two hour naps a day and the night is a tragedy, okay, now we have a problem. So it's not that I'm arbitrarily telling people to like not let their kids nap so much. I mean, if it's working, it's working. But if the night is a tragedy and we're like, hey, how do I help here? Well, human beings need to be awake to get sleepy. So if I'm trying to get an 8-month-old to take 2 2-hour naps a day, so 4 hours of naps a day, and I'm aiming for an 11-hour night because so-and-so on Instagram said that's the right number, that's 15 hours of sleep a day. Well, study after study is going to say, hey, 13 is the range, give or take an hour. So, you know, 14 to 12 is going to be the bell curve. 15, you're outside of the bell curve. Uh-huh. If they're sleeping great, no problem. Lucky you. But if they're not, the likely culprit is their body needs to be awake longer than 9 hours a day in order to accumulate sufficient sleep drive to sleep well at night.
Right.
And often it's a combination of two factors. It's how much time awake, how much sleep am I getting, and all combined with how am I falling asleep at bedtime? Because one of the other connections you'll see is if I am undertired, if I am not that sleepy and you put me in the crib, forget about it. No, right. No. So what happens when the kids protest bedtime is, well, we feed to sleep, we rock to sleep, we nurse to sleep, we whatever. Because, of course, like they're not going to fall asleep. They're not tired. It'd be like if I tried to go to bed at 7 p.m., I wouldn't be happy about it either. So I absolutely, feel their pain. They're like, I'm not tired. What do you want me to do here? So, yeah, there is some trial and error here, right? And I'm not saying that every child should be sleeping 13 hours a day. Absolutely not. But, you know, again, the behavior sort of suggests the direction that you might want to go as a parent if you're trying to troubleshoot, how do I help my child not wake up hourly all night long?
Mm-hmm. Are there any sort of telltale signs or things that a parent could look for if nighttime comes, they put the baby down to sleep? Let's say this particular baby is undertired. Are there telltale signs that a parent can figure out as to, you know, if the baby's crying or uncomfortable?
Yeah.
What do they look for?
So, again, if your child is used to being fully assisted to sleep, it is very hard to suss out. So let's take a scenario where I have a child where I have a beautiful, consistent bedtime routine and it's, you know, final feed of the night, bath, massage, PJs, we sing 2 books, they go into their crib awake, they fall asleep on their own, right? So that's what we call good sleep hygiene. They have good sleep hygiene. Here would be the signs I'm looking for. They take a long time to fall asleep, right? I really want babies falling asleep in 5 to 10 minutes. If they're kicking around in there for 20, 30, 40 minutes, all right, that's a signal. If they are awake for long periods of time in the middle of the night, let's say that the same child wakes up at 1 and 4 for a feeding, but it's not a quick feeding, they fall back to sleep. It's a feeding and then it's like 30 minutes of rocking or they're wide awake or they're really, you know, it's a production. They cannot fall back to sleep. That would be another signal. And you may not see all of these signals, but you're going to look for these kind of threads. Another thread would be that they struggle with every like light sleep phase where there's like, you know, not not massive upset, but like they just kind of complain and fuss for like 5 to 10 minutes every, you know, 70 minutes all night long. It could also be signs where as you get closer to morning, right, after they've slept, let's say 7, 8 hours, resuming sleep is a massive ordeal, meaning like when they wake up for their 4 a.m. feeding, the only way they're going to resume sleep is if I hold them for the duration of the night. Like it's just, you know, a preponderance of needing heavy amounts of soothing to resume sleep. And then you'd see a similar pattern during the day where like at nap time, they're not that tired. And it feels like parents will describe it as my baby fights sleep. My baby hates sleep. But a lot of times, you know, hating sleep, quote unquote, is really a signal that they're just not that tired yet.
Right.
You know,
right.
And there are kids who will start crying the minute you walk into their bedroom. And it's like, yeah, they're not tired. And they're just like, no. I don't want it. No. I want to stay and play where the fun is. I don't want to do this. You know, it could be some combination of signals. And again, if they're sleeping vastly more than 13 hours a day and you're seeing some of these signals, I'm going to be like, all right, let's start, you know, let's try for a few days experimenting and uh-huh. see how that feels. Uh-huh. Is your child comfortably staying awake longer than you thought they could? Are they disastrously miserable? Like what happens? Right. And most of the time, kids can actually handle being awake a lot longer than their parents believe. And I kind of convince them begrudgingly to give it a try. And they're like, oh, wow. Oh, that wasn't so bad.
Right.
So,
you know, there's obviously stages that children go through in their development, which obviously means during each stage, there may be differences in their sleep.
Sure.
So the parent who's trying to do the right thing, and let's say they finally master some of these things with this newborn, there's obviously going to be stages where they need to be making certain changes. Eventually, the baby gets its own bed, all these things. So I'd like to talk about some of those stages, some of the things that parents should be looking for and being prepared for. But before we talk about those, we absolutely have to take another break. So we will be back on Sleep Science Today with Alexis Dubieff right after the break.
The station that makes you feel good.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today.
All right. Welcome back. We left you with another cliffhanger, and we are going to be talking about stages of development for newborns, toddlers, children, and what that means about sleep and what parents should be looking for and preparing for.
So I think we talked about kind of the newborn period. So, you know, generally speaking, we consider babies out of the newborn phase at 3 months. And so from 3 to 6 months, a couple of things are happening. One is that is often the time where what was working, right, rocking, feeding, to sleep, whatever, starts to fail. And that is going to be a time where I'm going to encourage parents to start making gradual steps to help your child learn how to fall asleep in their crib. And gradual steps often could be pivoting from feed to sleep to rock to sleep, and then from rock to sleep to a baby awake in their crib with heavy parental presence, massaging their arms, butt pats, jiggling the crib, right? So we have a lot of options and a lot of time to kind of experiment with gradual changes to slowly help baby get used to the end point, which is a child who goes into their crib awake and does the full process of falling asleep on their own in their bed within 5 to 10 minutes, which is imminently feasible by 4 or 5 months, like imminently. So that is, if all things, the stars align, that's the goal. During this time period, you're also going to have a lot of kids who are like dropping naps, right? Because a newborn might take 6, 7, 8 naps a day. Most kids are going to be moving to 3 naps by 4 months. And then you're going to move to 2 naps between 6 to 8 months. So there's a, you know, period of a few months where the schedule is constantly changing and parents are like, well, I just figured out the schedule. Then 2 weeks later, does it work? And I'm like, I know. Like that's kind of the deal. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that babies co-room with their parents for 6 to 12 months. And, you know, that's, again, a conflict because most parents want babies out of their room because we do wake each other up. This is something we know. There are studies that back this up. And, you know, parents are tired of like ninja creeping into their room and the floor creaks and the baby's woken up and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I think that's a decision for parents to make with their pediatrician. But, you know, hopefully we would co-room for 6 months and then decide collectively, like, what is the right time to make that transition? Many, many babies are in bassinets or, you know, travel cribs, pack and plays in their parents' rooms. And, you know, getting them to fall asleep in their sleep space is the challenge, right? So getting a baby to fall asleep in the bassinet is the hard part. Moving from the bassinet to the crib when the time is right is a nominal issue. So, you know, for many U.S. parents, I think they're going to talk to their pediatricians and want to move their kids around 6 months. Certainly not a must. And I think every family makes their own decision. But I don't want to be clear. Like a lot of people worry about moving from the pack and play to the crib or the bassinet to the crib. That is not your worry. The worry is getting them falling asleep, not on a caregiver's body, really. So, you know. And then similarly for night weaning, you know, babies will often continue eating at night because bodies work on a supply and demand. So if I'm constantly putting food in at X time, the body's going to say, hey, it's X time. I'm creating hunger signals. So when, you know, again, with a pediatrician, if you've decided that it's time to eliminate some night feedings and all parties are unambiguously, you know, united in this goal, you know, that's a great time. Again, 4 to 6 months is a great time to wean off one or two night feedings, again, based on the parent's goals and the pediatrician's input. So my goal is always to have a plan to say, what is our pathway to 6 hours of sleep for the parent? Like, what does that look like? And 6 hours of sleep does not mean going to bed at 7 p.m. because no parent is going to do that. So 6 hours of sleep would be baby goes to bed between 7 and 8. I go to bed at 10. I sleep 10 to 4. We have a feeding. Baby goes back down. And, you know, some families want to have more feedings than that for longer, which is absolutely their choice. But for all parents, I'd kind of say like, okay, great. But like, think about when and how everybody in your family can get 6 hours of sleep. Because that's the bare minimum to kind of sort of function. I mean, that doesn't feel fantastic. But that's kind of like, you know, you can kind of limp along like that versus if I'm feeding at 1 and 4 and I go to bed at 10, I'm basically taking a couple of naps at night.
Right. Right.
So, you know, again, some families will say, hey, nursing's really important to me. I'm happy to do it three times a night. Like, great. That's, you get to make that choice. But I would say most of the parents that I'm talking to are sort of like, yeah, 6 months, I'm ready. Like, let's get 6 hours. That sounds great. And then, you know, so if I think about 6 to 12 months, hopefully kids are falling asleep on their own. They're, when time comes, moving into their own room, moving away from eating more, you know, the goal for me, for most parents, would be 0 to 1 times a night based on your goals and your preferences. And then we kind of slide into toddlerhood. Most toddlers are moving into one nap territory. And, you know, most toddlers are sleeping 10 hours a night. And that's a long-term trend. So once you kind of hit that, then you're going to, that's going to be your cruising night sleep duration for a decade, right? So, pre-puberty.
Right.
So then the only real sleep change is, when does our kid stop napping entirely, which for most is anywhere between 2 and 5, but commonly around 3. So if we set things up, you know, again, if the stars align and we get everything kind of going at 6 months, yeah, there's some blips and blurbs. Kids get sick. We got time zone changes when we travel and daylight savings and like things happen. But it's not usually too terrible. I will say by, you know, 2 and 3, you start to see a lot more creative bedtime protest behaviors. You know, right. I have to poop, fix my blanket, like, one more book. And that can lead parents on a merry chase because they're like, oh my gosh, what's going on? And I would just say, like, we want to remember that falling asleep on their own is the key to the kingdom. So if I'm climbing right into my 3-year-old's bed and staying until they're asleep, I need to be prepared that they're going to wake up all night long and be like, hey, where'd you go? So the basics of sleep hygiene that apply to babies applies to toddlers. And some people will tell me, well, it's hardly with toddlers. They have words. I'm like, no, it's better with toddlers because they have words. It's a dialogue, right? And so when they're like, mom, you climb into bed, mom, cuddle. Yeah, that's heartbreaking because who doesn't want to do that? But right. I also now can communicate. I can say, hey, buddy, I love cuddling with you. Let's cuddle in the morning if they're using a toddler alarm clock, when the light turns green. Hey, buddy, I love you. I love cuddling with you. But right now, I'm going to go help dad walk the dog so that we can get ready for bed too, because my body needs rest too. And so now it's a dialogue. I'm telling you what I'm going to do, right? Like, right. It's not just with a baby where I'm like, hey. So, you know, if we hold on to these basic truths, right sleep schedule, good sleep hygiene, falling asleep independently, you know, when we look at sleep problems in toddlerhood, we have the same tools to kind of figure out why are things not working right now? Is this a sign that my child no longer can sleep 11 hours a night, that they're settling down to 10? Is this a sign that they're ready to be done napping?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of parents will. Go ahead.
Well, go ahead. Finish the thought.
I was going to say, a lot of parents, like when your child's moving out of the nap phase, like you have a 3-year-old, they're kind of done napping. You're going to have a period of time where if they nap, they can't fall asleep until 10, 11 o'clock at night. And nobody wants to parent a toddler at 11 o'clock at night. I don't care how delightful your toddler is. By 10 o'clock at night, we're like, I'm done. But if they don't nap, they're like, you know, they're like piss and vinegar all afternoon. So, right. You know, sometimes we have to make uncomfortable choices about which is the least bad option as I transition to this path. Overwhelmingly, what I hear from parents is I'll take an 8 o'clock bedtime and a rough afternoon versus, again, toddler parenting till 11, because that's tough, especially for, you know, working parents who are like, I need a break. I just can't do it.
For sure. Yeah. Well, I was going to ask before, I'm sure that you have some advice for that period where the parents first move the child from their room into the child's own room. Because I have to imagine that that's a pretty big adjustment for everybody. And there's got to be some things that we can expect are going to occur during that time and things that you can do to minimize any sort of disruption.
Honestly, I think the biggest part of that transition for many parents is a bit of a loss. There's an unnamed grief that happens because a wise friend of mine once said, parenting is the long letting go. And I find this is true almost daily. And so when we first give birth and we have to hold this child 24 hours a day and feed them 24 hours a day, it is an intense, painful, but intense level of togetherness. And the first time we move our child to sleep in their own room, this is part of letting go. This is now a separation. And I think a lot of parents actually struggle with a certain amount of sadness around that. And so I just wanted to name that because I think a lot of parents don't consciously have awareness that that's what's happening. From a sleep perspective, if we have the right schedule and our child is falling asleep independently, the move to their own room is minor. It is really not a big deal. There might be some small disruption the first night, maybe takes a little bit longer to fall asleep at bedtime, but it is not a huge deal. Most parents have, prior to giving birth, like done an amazing job setting their infants' rooms up. Most parents understand the things about why blackout curtains are a wise investment and their children's rooms are like basically ideal sleep environments. You know, there's very little light, you know, comfortable temperatures, appropriate humidity. You know, modern parents have unbelievable night monitoring technology available to them. So, you know, it's not like, you know, in the olden days where you just like listened through the wall, right? Like now we're like, I can see what my child's doing. I can see if they're awake. I can see if I absolutely know if they're distressed, regardless of where our house layout is. So I think really it's the big hurdle is an emotional one. And, you know, also I think there's a fear of SIDS, I think, because, you know, we know that co-rooming is leads to a slight reduction. And so then there's like this issue of, am I doing something dangerous? And that's why I'm like, let's talk to our pediatricians. Let's, you know, make this a shared decision where we all feel comfortable and there's no rush to make a change until all parties are excited about it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I just would have expected that it would have been a much bigger shock to the child or something, but
I mean, the good news is most of us are moving kids at a time where they're, I mean, I jokingly say like most of our babies are kind of like goldfish where the little plastic castle is a surprise every time. And so, you know, when we say, oh, this is a new space, well, the concept of a new space is only new if I have a strongly developed sense of like yesterday.
Right.
So like for a toddler, it's a big deal. If you have a toddler who's been sleeping in your room for 2 years and you're like, hey, it's time to, you know, we're having a new baby. You got to move out. This is going to be a challenge, 100%. If we're talking about a 6-month-old, it really isn't a big deal.
Interesting. Wow. Well, this has been a lot of really interesting information and very helpful information. And unfortunately, we have reached the end of our time, but I really appreciate you coming on and sharing all this. Again, I want to remind people that your book is Precious Little Sleep. Is that available everywhere or where can they find it?
Everywhere. Internationally, audiobook. It's available in Chinese, Korean, Bulgarian.
Gosh, wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful. Well, thank you. This has been Alexis Dubieff. And I appreciate you taking the time to join us. I encourage you to take a look at her book, Precious Little Sleep. And we'll see you on the next episode of Sleep Science Today.
You have been listening to Sleep Science Today, your number one sleep authority.
Sleep Science Today.